This is the third in a series of audio presentations produced by Whitewater Grand Jury witness Patrick Knowlton and his lawyer, John H. Clark. You will hear Mr. Knowlton on this audio. You will also hear the voice of Assistant United States Attorney Miguel Rodriguez and the voice of Associate White House Counsel Brett Kavanaugh. Both Kavanaugh and Rodriguez served as Associate Independent Counsel under Kenneth Starr. Starr chose Kavanaugh to replace Rodriguez. In 1994 and 1995, Miguel Rodriguez was the lead prosecutor investigating Mr. Foster's death. Rodriguez thoroughly reviewed all of the federal records in the Foster case. Despite Ken Starr's and the FBI's attempts to hide the first-generation crime scene photographs from him, Rodriguez discovered the original photographs. Miguel Rodriguez is the leading government authority on the evidence. He witnessed criminal activity in the Office of Independent Counsel.
Miguel Rodriguez from the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, it's one thing to have read 10,000 pages worth of documents and to know what I know. I mean, facts are a strange thing because they can't be denied. And, you know, and like, for example, the 35 millimeters, the hand is in a different position than in the polarized. And they're like, so if you look at some of the reeds or some of the little weed fibers coming up through his hands, they're different on photographs. Different photographs indicate different positions based on the vegetation.
From the photographic evidence, Rodriguez knew the perpetrators staged the crime scene. The press publicized the search of Fort Marcy Park for the fatal bullet to give the public the impression Starr was doing a thorough investigation. The bullet was never found, because it remained in Foster's head. Rodriguez discovered that the FBI, with the assistance of Dr. James Beyer, had destroyed the evidence that showed the bullet remained in Foster's brain. People asked Rodriguez if exhuming Foster's body for an X-ray could reveal the bullet trajectory.
Certainly won't find a brain there. We sure don't have any way to show what the track of the bullet was, if in fact a bullet came from inside the mouth of it.
The United States Court of Appeals appointed Starr as independent counsel. Starr appointed Rodriguez to investigate Foster's death. Rodriguez soon discovered he was not in control of the investigation, but rather the FBI was, along with Justice Department prosecutors who had controlled the outcome of the Fisk report. The result of the probe, Rodriguez learned, was predetermined.
These people don't know what they're doing. They don't know what the FBI is doing. The FBI comes in there and says, we're going to do this. If you want to have someone monitor us, you're welcome to it. I do this all the time. This is, you know, a simple investigation. You know, the FBI comes in, shows a badge, they do whatever they want.
The public would expect an investigation to examine telephone records of calls made to and from Vince Foster around the time of his death. Kavanaugh wrote in the Star report that phone records indicated a call was placed from the White House residence at exactly 10:06 p.m. on the night of Foster's death. In the same paragraph, Kavanaugh also wrote, quote, complete records for such calls are not available, unquote. Rodriguez reveals that the Office of Independent Counsel never subpoenaed any White House telephone records of calls from anyone, including Vince Foster.
Telephone records are not a window into anything, because the telephone records are only going to be as good as what the FBI asked for. Whatever else I'm saying is this, okay? There is no way, based on what I knew of what was subpoenaed, to confirm or deny that somebody made any particular telephone call at any particular time, and that includes Vince Foster.
Originating in England and frequently referred to as the People's Panel, the grand jury was valued as a kind of people's watchdog. In 1743, it twice refused to indict newspaper publisher John Peter Zenger for criminal libel for criticizing the colonial governor. A pre-constitutional institution, and still a People's Panel, it is not captive or regulated to any branch by the Constitution. The grand jury is meant to be a vital check and balance to protect the people from government abuse. After his departure, Miguel Rodriguez encouraged journalists to write articles to educate the public and the grand jurors about their powers. He realized that the common person was the last bastion of hope.
Let me interject one thought. The only fertile ground here for getting a full accounting done. And I mean even beyond what Congress is capable of doing, is to target the grand jury. Everyone else is going to be politically motivated. I've met this grand jury. I know how pissed they are, and I know how confused they are, and I know how dissatisfied they are. And attempts to empower them, to tell them that they can demand more, will go a long way. They remain your friend. They remain citizens who are not interested in the political process, who don't know it, don't care about it. They want to know what happened because they're curious, interested people. And they don't know what kind of power they have. Empowering the grand jury, letting them know what they can demand, what they should be wary of, what their independent subpoena powers are, whether they have the authority to ask questions on their own in the grand jury, to take charge of this as the representatives of the public. You know what I'm saying? The public. In other words, they're not the real bastion of hope out there is the common person, not the politics of the Congress, not the politics of an independent counsel. The real check and balance here is the grand jury, the common person, selected at random. And they need to pound their fist. They're capable of doing it. And, you know, they're the best you've got. They read the Post. You know, when I used to go into the grand jury, I'd see them reading the Post and the Times on these articles. You know, when I was in the paper a lot, they were reading them, trying to get me to talk about them, the articles. They follow all of it very carefully. And you target them, and they're going to feel empowered. That's going to piss Starr and people like Toohey off more than anything else.
The press did the opposite. Their articles undermined the grand jury. Who were the unnamed government sources that fed the Washington Post and Washington Times information that undermined the grand jury? Rodriguez called a Wall Street Journal article by Ellen Joan Pollack on March 23, 1995, nonsense, pernicious, and harmful.
That Pollack article was nonsense. There's so much manipulation going on in terms of what these people are trying to make people believe. It's pernicious. It's harmful. This is all spin being put on put out by certain people to manipulate not only the readership, but you people have no idea how you affect an investigation. You know, if I walk into grand jury on the same day that some, you know, Post article says that the Stars reached an opposite conclusion of what I'm doing, where is it, someone getting that information? Where are they timing? Why are they timing it so perfectly to undermine what I'm doing and the attitudes? It's very, very disturbing on that aspect and how powerful Saul is.
Miguel Rodriguez discovered that the investigators were treating witnesses inappropriately. Deputy Independent Counsels John Bates and Mark Toohey and Associate Independent Counsel Brett Kavanaugh used the FBI to harass and intimidate witnesses who had no reason to lie. Witnesses who told investigators Foster's gray car was not at Fort Marcy Park were re-interviewed, harassed, and intimidated. The goal of Starr's office was to silence witnesses whose accounts contradicted its desired result.
And it's unfortunate because there are so many people who, you know, have tried to stand up for what they believe is their integrity and their truth. And, you know, a whole lot of us are getting really just the shit kicked out of us. But one thing that I met fierce opposition to in the trenches inside of Independent Counsel was this. I was really upset that the witnesses who had no incentive to lie, and this is the way I phrased it, Why is the FBI harassing and re-interviewing witnesses who have no incentive to lie, and yet we are treating with rubber gloves persons who do have an incentive to lie, and or at least not to be a bit candid, and who have in fact made misstatements involving questionable conduct? What does this guy Knowlton have to gain in saying something that he said at the outset and continues to say today? And he should take an incredulous, and others should take an incredulous attitude, like, why are you questioning me? Even in the grand jury, you can respond this way. People don't know it. Why are you following me? Why are you, and, you know, if Knowlton wants to make a statement, he certainly welcomes, you know, there's no problem with him. Why am I being followed? Why was I being harassed in the grand jury? Knowlton should find comfort in the fact that he's not alone. He needs to know that. But the guy's a damn hero. What they're trying to do, they're trying to discredit him by making him out to be, you know, cruising at a park. The reality is, you know, we had this fight a year ago, and I was literally, I was irate with Toohey and the FBI agents who were snickering and laughing with Brett about this, and I was just livid, and I said, I don't even care, I don't care if they were there for their favorite tree, I said. The fact of the matter is, if they know what they saw, that doesn't discount them as for having a ability to recall what they saw with their own, you know, and I don't care, if they're f***ing their favorite tree. The FBI finds it particularly funny. There's a pattern in all of the treatment of all of the witnesses. It's absolutely crystal clear, and you can only see it when you've gone through the 10,000, 15,000 documents. And when you do so, you'll see that there's a pattern of basically harassing and misstating people who are sort of the innocent bystanders, including the EMTs, and the people who are law enforcement and FBI and White House are being interviewed once and accepted as something true.
The EMTs are outstanding people.
All outstanding people.
They really are.
You know, no, actually, with upon review of all of the documents in this case, my observation and statements that I indicated to Toohey and Starr was that witnesses who had no incentive to lie were being unduly questioned inappropriately. And persons with no incentive to lie were being inappropriately treated. I think I could stand by that. That was, you know, that's something that I believed. I believed it from the outset. You know, people like the, you know, park police would never ask tough questions. I try to ask them a tough question, and they beat the hell out of me. It was just bass-ackwards.
The public has no way to know how many witnesses may have been harassed and intimidated. Journalists Michael Isikoff, Steve Labaton, Micah Morrison, Matt Drudge, and others spoke to Patrick Knowlton about his being harassed, but no stories appeared. By not reporting witnesses' stories, journalists aid the perpetrators in silencing witnesses. Crime scene witnesses include civilians Gene Slade, Judith Duty, Mark Feist, Patrick Knowlton, Park Service workers Chuck Stow, Francis Swan, as well as rescue workers Todd Hall, Richard Arthur, George Gonzalez, Ralph Pisani, Jennifer Wacha, Corey Ashford, William Bianchi, Victoria Jacobs, Roger Harrison, Andrew McCooch, the coroner's wife, and two unnamed tow truck drivers. The public does not know of these people or their stories. One person's story that did receive media attention was the story of the confidential witness known as C.W. His name is Dale Kyle of Midland, Virginia, and his statements and his deposition are not consistent with the facts. Patrick Knowlton called the authorities to report what he had witnessed. In the months leading up to his Whitewater grand jury appearance, the FBI interviewed Knowlton three times, vandalized his car, and caused him to be intimidated in his home and on the streets of Washington, D.C. Mr. Knowlton had seen a suspicious man at Fort Marcy Park who may have been involved in the murder of Vince Foster. After testifying for 2.5 hours before the grand jury, what interested Prosecutor Kavanaugh about this unknown man at the park about 90 minutes before the discovery of Foster's body? Kavanaugh asked Knowlton, quote, "Did he touch your genitals?" Unquote.
Who asked him if he touched his hand? Oh, jeez. Oh. Brett stooped that low. I can't believe Brett did that.
Why did Brett Kavanaugh ask Knowlton the suspicious man had touched his genitals? Why did these prosecutors stoop to that level to discredit a witness? Patrick Knowlton saw something very significant in the parking lot. Nine other witnesses saw the same thing. An old brown car with Arkansas license plates, not Foster's newer gray car. Mr. Foster was already dead when witnesses saw the brown car. This fact proves the official story that Vince Foster drove to the park and shot himself is false. The strategy of Starr's prosecutors was to convince the grand jury that witnesses like Patrick Knowlton had not been harassed. During Patrick Knowlton's grand jury testimony, Brett Kavanaugh said, quote, "Tell us about the alleged harassment, Mr. Knowlton," unquote. Knowlton replied, quote, "It was not alleged. It happened," unquote. FBI agent Russell Bransford served the subpoena on Knowlton and later intimidated and harassed him. At the grand jury, Knowlton repeatedly asked Bates and Kavanaugh to tell him who had sent FBI agent Bransford to his home. Kavanaugh responded twice that they were not there to answer Knowlton's questions. When Knowlton adamantly asked again, John Bates, who was seated behind Patrick, said, quote, "We sent Bransford," unquote. Patrick Knowlton tells us how his grand jury testimony ended.
Prior to going to the grand jury, I was harassed and intimidated on the streets of Washington, and during that time, the three-day period, my attorney, John Clark, repeatedly called the FBI and the OIC's office. They never responded to give me any protection or any help. It wasn't until the following Monday that Russell Bransford showed up at my door, and he interviewed me regarding the harassment. All the time I was telling him the story of what took place, he sat there and smiled at me. And when I asked him at one point if I could trust him, he leaned over into my face and said, "Mr. Knowlton, that's a good question. I don't know." Well, I was looking forward to going to the grand jury and telling them a story about my harassment. And at that time, I didn't realize that the OIC and the FBI were behind it. I remember when I went to the grand jury, and towards the end of this 2.5-hour interview, I was asked by Brett Kavanaugh to step outside of the grand jury room so the grand jurors could ask questions. When I re-entered the room, Kavanaugh first asked me if I was sure that someone in the park didn't see me. And I replied that I hoped that someone else had seen me in the park. Then he sarcastically asked me whether I came forward to the authorities because I was a good citizen or a good Samaritan. Then John Bates, who was seated behind me, leaned forward and passed a note to Brett Kavanaugh, from which Kavanaugh read the following questions. He said, "Mr. Knowlton, did the man in the park talk to you?" Which I replied, "No." He asked me, "Did the man in the park pass you a note?" And I replied, "No." He said, "Did the man in the park approach you?" Which I replied, "No." "Did the man in the park point a gun at you?" Which I replied, "No." And lastly, Kavanaugh asked me, "Did the man in the park touch your genitals?" I looked at him and I was in shock. I mean, I was dumbfounded. I couldn't believe he'd asked me such a question. Of course, I replied, "No." As I left the grand jury, I was puzzled why the grand jurors would ask such questions. And as soon as I saw my attorney, John Clark, I repeated verbatim the last questions I was asked. But now we know why those questions were designed by John Bates and Brett Kavanaugh. They wanted to discredit me and my testimony. Bates and Kavanaugh knew Foster's car, that gray car, was not in the parking lot when Foster was dead. They also knew that all the other witnesses and I saw the brown car in that small parking lot. No one in that park saw Foster's gray car. The press and the government claim that Vincent Foster drove to the park and shot himself. The fact is, Foster did not drive to the park. He did not commit suicide.
Brett Kavanaugh was asked what evidence he had to prove that Foster's car was at the crime scene.
Well, I guess some of it depends on whether... Well, we know there was a car there. and I guess the question is whether that, so there's evidence. Other than that, no one saw it being moved out, and you know, that it had Arkansas plates. You know, I'd have to go back to the report again and give you a full answer on that. But I guess that's an unanswerable question.
Kavanaugh's answer did not provide any evidence that Foster's car was at the crime scene. Kavanaugh implies that the Star report was fair because it states that one witness saw a brown car at the park. However, Kavanaugh was not telling the whole truth. Witnesses saw a brown car, and none of those witnesses saw a gray car.
I'm just going to stand by the report. On that, it does point out what C2 saw in the park. It doesn't ignore the car that he saw. So I'll have to look at it. But I know C2. You know what he saw. That's described. Isn't the color as described by C2? That's indicated, I believe, which is not the same color. Brown, rust colored. I mean, it's all about the inferences. Obviously, you know, obviously one inference is the car he saw is the same car. Another inference is that it's not.
Kavanaugh is not telling the whole truth when he states that Starr's report cites one witness seeing a brown car, and his one and only reference to the brown car was not in the section of the report that discussed Foster's car at the park. Kavanaugh is asked a second time about witnesses who saw the brown car. Listen to Kavanaugh use the phrase, "those facts," to avoid using the words "brown car."
What you don't like, and I understand this, so I'm not going to get defensive or offensive, is that the you know, you think those facts lead to a certain conclusion, and the report suggests that those facts do not necessarily lead to any conclusion other than, you know, inconsistent with the ultimate findings. So that's just a debate about what inferences you would take from the facts that are there compared to the inferences taken by the report, which is fine. People disagree about that all the time. I mean, the Star report seems definitive, and not definitive, you wouldn't agree, but at least in discussing the physical evidence and why it's unlikely what was in the scene in the parking lot contradicts any of that. I think that's the actual phrasing that's used. But there's nothing, I didn't think there was anything ignored. I'll go back and look at that, though.
For the third time, Kavanaugh is asked what evidence he had to prove that Foster's gray car was at the scene.
That's the question, that there was questions about whether people were misdescribing colors or something like that. Now, that's one inference. Again, another inference is that there was another car, and that's just a... And then there's a third inference, I suppose, which is that his car, the gray car, wasn't there, and that they switched the cars after the engine arrived. That's an inference.
Kavanaugh is asked a fourth time what evidence he had that Foster's car was in the parking lot. Either Foster's car was there, or it was not.
Well, at least the report. Look, the report was trying to be honest about a few things, and that people had complained about with this report. And one of them was the fact that there were these cars, and people saw different cars and different people. Well, what about the people? I mean, this gets to a problem. What about the people who seemed clearly to see Foster's car and described it as brown? So people were screwed up on the colors, period.
Kavanaugh is right. There is a problem.
Well, what about the people? I mean, this gets to a problem. What about the people who seemed clearly to see Foster's car and described it as brown?
Kavanaugh's statement that people clearly saw Foster's car is not true. Descriptions of a brown car are not descriptions of Foster's gray car. How does Kavanaugh resolve the problem?
So people were screwed up on the colors, period.
Brett Kavanaugh called eyewitnesses screwed up because what they saw did not agree with the desired result. But Kavanaugh slipped up. He admitted that all of the police and medical personnel saw a brown car.
Well, it all comes down to that brown car issue, right? All the police and medical personnel were in the park also described it as brown.
The conclusion that Vincent Foster committed suicide depends on yet another provable lie, that Foster drove his children's gray Honda to Fort Marcy Park. Patrick Knowlton and all the other witnesses were correct. There was no gray car in the parking lot. We just heard Kavanaugh admit that all witnesses were consistent, that the car was brown, proving that Foster did not drive his children's car to the park. Earlier in this audio, we heard Kavanaugh admit that the civilian witnesses reported seeing a brown car and claimed to believe that all these civilians were simply mistaken or screwed up. But 24 officials arrived at the park that night, and Kavanaugh admits that these 24 police and medical personnel all saw a brown car.
All the police and medical personnel were in the park also described it as brown.
Kavanaugh learned of this evidence, disproving the suicide theory, from grand jury testimony, yet Kavanaugh knowingly withheld this evidence from Starr's report on Foster's death and submitted the report to the United States Court of Appeals to the Special Division for the purpose of appointing independent counsels. Did Kenneth Starr knowingly allow John Bates and Brett Kavanaugh to submit a fraudulent report to the United States Court of Appeals? Kavanaugh was willing to do what Miguel Rodriguez was not willing to do, to lie. Kavanaugh's lie that Vincent Foster drove to the park and killed himself was made to perpetuate the cover-up of the murder. Brett Kavanaugh and John Bates were among those young, aspiring people about whom Miguel Rodriguez said, "We'll do what is necessary to move up the ladder," quote-unquote. And move up the ladder they have. John Bates is now a federal district court judge in Washington, D.C., and Brett Kavanaugh serves as an official in the White House. President Bush recently nominated Kavanaugh to be a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit.
I am Patrick Knowlton, the producer of these audios. We have shown that our government and our press have been caught in a provable lie. When our leaders and our press are covering up murder, the safety and well-being of the American people are threatened. If our press and the government will lie to us about the murder of a White House official, we should ask ourselves, what else are they lying to us about? The truth is, the American people cannot trust their government and press to tell them the truth about anything.